What's on your mind? What have you been thinking about? What occupies your thoughts? The things that are on our mind are extremely important. They have a big impact on us, of course. And we see a lot of commands in the Bible specifically about our thoughts. So what we think about and the things that we think about, the things that are on our minds, are very important. We ask that casually sometimes to each other, what's on your mind? Especially when we see concern or a reason for concern. We'll ask, what's on your mind? But it's something we should be also thinking about personally. What's on my mind? What do I think about? Where do I tend to go in my thoughts? We have specific things that we're supposed to think about, actually, and things that we're encouraged to not spend as much time on. Today we'll look at some of the commands specifically about what we're supposed to be thinking and try to focus ourselves and just be recentered in terms of where we need to have our minds. If you turn over to 2 Corinthians 10, we'll see one of those commands here about our thoughts. 2 Corinthians 10, and let's start in, we'll start in verse 5. We'll start with the familiar part. Breaking into the thought. It says, casting down arguments and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ. So we've probably heard that many times about bringing every thought into captivity. The full context of this really starts back in verse 2. Paul's saying, but I beg you that when I am present, I may not be bold with that confidence by which I intend to be bold against some who think of us as if we walked according to the flesh. So he's telling them, I will be coming, and I expect that I will have to be a little heavy-handed with some of those who think that who talk about us in a way like we're carnal people. And he says, for though we walk in the flesh, we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. And elsewhere he says, we don't walk according to the flesh. We walk in the flesh. We walk in these physical bodies, but we don't walk in a way that is just carnal and earthly. We're supposed to walk in a way that is spiritual. And so here he says, we do not war according to the flesh. And so here's where he breaks into this war terminology, really. He's talking about warring according to the flesh. In verse 4, he says, the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty in God for pulling down strongholds, casting down arguments, and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ, and being ready to punish all disobedience when your obedience is fulfilled. So he gets into this concept of warfare is really where he's going with it. He's saying this is spiritual warfare, and this is a spiritual battle. He uses a lot of military terminology. He says we war not according to the flesh. He talks about our weapons for pulling down strongholds, you know, big fortresses, for pulling these down, tearing these things down, casting down arguments and every high thing that exalts itself. And so this bringing every thought into captivity is taking captives. It's a military terminology. It's attacking and taking captives. There are two possible aspects of this. That one of them is bringing down taking our own thoughts captive. So the things that we have, the things from within, the thoughts that are generated from within, being able to take our own thoughts that might bubble up and take those captive in that sense and subject them. Secondly, and what some of the commentaries feel like he might also be referring to here is in his work as an evangelist, as preaching the gospel, taking all of the thoughts that would battle against Christianity, taking those captive and being able to pull them down or to suppress them. So in his day, a lot of Greek philosophy, some of the splinters of Judaism that were seeping into the church, and Gnosticism and all the other concepts, taking those thoughts that were coming at the church, that were battling against the church, being able to take those captive. So from that sense, it's taking the thoughts from without and being able to take those things that come at you and take those captive and subject them. Right? And again, in very strong military terminology, being able to take thoughts, whether they're coming from within you, they're thoughts that maybe you have generated, or thoughts that are being thrown at you and sort of pushed at you, and being able to take those captive. So either way, there's a personal responsibility to be taking thoughts and making them subject to something, subjecting them to, well, as he says, bring every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ. So we see here, all right, we need to take thoughts, whether they're ours, whether they're things that come at us, because we're bombarded with ideas, you know, every day, all day. Different people will push different ideas. News will push different ideas, depending on which news channel you're watching. Media all over, you know, you'll go to watch a movie and you'll sit down and watch a movie, and halfway through you realize that this is a message movie with an agenda trying to push something at you, right? There are thoughts pushed at us. There are things pushed onto us that we need to be able to properly subject. So what's our standard for subjecting? What's our metric to say, is this something that I need to dwell on and need to have in my mind? Let's turn over to Philippians 4. Philippians 4, here at the end of the letter to the Philippians, Paul is encouraging them to do a number of things. And in the first few verses, he's encouraging them in a lot of different ways. He gets to verse 8. And he says, finally, whatever things are true, whatever things are noble, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, if there's any virtue and if there's anything praiseworthy, meditate on these things. He gives us some criteria. He says, here's the metric for saying, here's what you should be thinking about. Here's what you should or shouldn't be dwelling on. Here's what you should have in your mind. There's an article from the United News in January of last year that speaks to this verse. It says, Philippians 4:8 is a passage we normally consider to be a list of things we should meditate on. And it is. So it's a list of things that these are things we need to judge our thoughts by. But it is also a list of 7 internal character traits we should strive to develop. In his commentary, Adam Clark tells us that think on these things means we should esteem them highly, recommend them heartily, and practice them fervently. So they're things that we need to have in our minds and be judging as criteria for our thoughts and for what we are thinking about. But there are also things that we need to be putting into practice, and we'll see more of that later. But just keep in mind, we're going to go through these elements here. These things are things for us to meditate on in that sense, but also things to be. They're things for us to think and things for us to be. And there are principles you'll see throughout some of the scriptures that really our thoughts turn into who we are, turn into our actions. So we need to not just be thinking these things, but then becoming these things. And of course, it works the other direction. If we want to become these things, we need to be thinking these things. We need to be dwelling on these things. So it's a list of things to meditate on, and it's a list of qualities that we need to develop. It's not a couple of things. This isn't just a bunch of nice, happy things. He's not just saying, think good thoughts. You know, there's some of that mentality out there, and some of that in some of the New Age religions, that you just need to think good thoughts and the universe will reward you. He's not saying this is just, oh, think good thoughts. It's not that simple, and we'll get into some of the details on that. It's also not an excuse to ignore the unpleasant things that you have to deal with in your life. It's not an excuse to say, oh, well, I don't want to think about that. That's not nice. That doesn't make me feel good, so I'm not going to think about it. You know, there are things that we have to deal with daily that are unpleasant to have to think about. And so we do still have to deal with those things. There are still obviously unpleasant things that we have come into our lives. But these qualities should describe the things that our mind is centered on. These should be the things that we dwell on. Some of the translations actually say dwell on these things. These are the things that when you come back to those quiet moments where you have time to just sit and think, these should be the descriptors for those things, right? Doesn't mean you'll never have an unpleasant thought or have to deal with an unpleasant thing or have to judge and discern about something unpleasant. It just means that your central thoughts, the things that you'll come back to, the things that you like to think about, the things that you really enjoy mulling over in your mind, should be these things. They should be described by these qualities. They shouldn't just be, you know, you shouldn't be going back to things that are trivial or obviously evil. So that said, let's start into the list. He says, whatever things are true. True here means open, not concealed. Living a life of truth. This word is used often in the New Testament to describe witness. You can reference John 8:17 there, where it says the testimony of two men is true. It's a true witness. It's, again, as opposed to bearing false witness. This is true. This is truth. This Jesus used this same word to describe the Word of God, to describe the Bible. In John 17:17, he says, sanctify them through your truth. Your word is truth. So it's something, again, true, absolute truth. This same word is used in the Septuagint, in the Greek translation of the Old Testament. The same Greek word is used where English translations have true or righteous or wise. It's that type of true. It's just absolute. It's true and good. In contrast, we have things that are speculation, right? Sometimes we'll speculate about things. Speculation isn't inherently wrong, as long as we realize it's speculation, but it's not all-out truth. And so it's not the kind of thing that we need to just dwell on, is what he's saying here. Sometimes we'll hear rumor. Rumor isn't, again, it's something that you might have to process and say, is that worth addressing? Do I need to talk to somebody about whatever? Hopefully the source. But, you know, a rumor is partial truth, maybe at best. Politics, we'll get information fed to us from the TV about, oh, here's the latest going on in politics, and this is how it is. You know, you'll hear one newscaster or one person say, here's how this is. Again, is that truth? It's not absolute truth, and so it doesn't need to be the things that we go back to and just mull over all the time. Those kinds of things are, I mean, politics is really, it's muddled at best. It's muddy. It's hard to discern the truth from the error in terms of politics, and half the time there isn't any. So, you know, it's not where we need to be centered. We need to dwell on the things that are true, and then be true. We need to be true and truthful people. We need to be a people that are like God. Jesus described God as true, that same word. John 8:26. He says God is true. The next word in the list is translated a number of different ways. The New King James is translated noble, and noble is probably a really solid translation of it. In some translations, it's rendered as honest. But I think it's honest in a more archaic usage. It means serious-minded, venerable, respected, esteemed, admired, honorable, and honest as sort of qualities within that overall concept. Paul uses this word, honest, in 1 Timothy to describe the qualities of deacons and their wives. He uses this word in Titus to describe the older men. He says, let the older men be noble, is how he calls them. We have living examples of that here in this congregation. You can think of, without calling people out, you can think of some of the deacons and some of the elders, some of the older men in our congregation, and you can think, oh yes, they're respectable, they're admirable. Those are the kind of qualities that are befitting older men, is what Paul is telling us. And so we have examples of that. We have living examples of that quality. And that's something that we're to develop and we're to grow in ourselves as we, you know, with age, hopefully we're developing that same quality. You know, in contrast, you can think of, you know, there's this portrayal in any number of movies, and everybody probably knows somebody like this in real life. You'll think of the older man who's lived many, many years and looks very austere and very noble, but acts like a child. It's a stark contrast. It just doesn't fit, right? It doesn't seem quite right. There's something out of alignment there. And that person, that type of person, isn't thought of as noble, as respected, as honorable. So those things, the noble things, the honorable things, those are the things that we're, you know, we should be thinking about those things. Thinking about the people that set that kind of example and becoming that ourselves. And of course, Jesus Christ sets the example in all of these things and is an excellent example for us in that respect. The next word is just. Just means equitable in character and in action, innocent, righteous. In the New Testament, it often describes those who have been justified. It'll talk about the just. It'll talk about the same word will be rendered just or righteous. And so it'll talk about the righteous, when the righteous enter into the kingdom. And it often has a legal sense to it. These are the people who have been justified. These are the people who God has justified, that God has taken away whatever requirements were against them and has justified them. And these people are just and righteous, and they have nothing against them. Again, Paul in Titus 1:8, he describes the requirements of an elder as one who is just. You want somebody who is just and fair in his dealings? That's what you want. Jesus Christ in John 5:30, he says that his judgment is just. So, especially in that sense, especially if you're standing in a legal sense before a judge, you want somebody who's just. You want somebody who's equitable. Right? The contrast there would be somebody who is crafty or cunning. These are actually antonyms to that Greek word. The example would be a corrupt judge. If you had a judge who was sitting in judgment and who was judging based on some ulterior motives, who had been bribed, swindled, corrupted somehow, that sort of unjust, unfair, imbalanced measure of judgment, those qualities don't describe the kinds of things that we should be filling our minds with. So we shouldn't be centered on the ideas and the examples of injustice. We don't need to be focused there. We're encouraged to be just. In Romans 1:17, Paul says that the just shall live by faith. He's quoting the Old Testament. He's quoting Habakkuk. And again, the just, the Christians are expected to be just. It's part of the basic description that we have. So we're to think equitably and fairly. We're to think innocently in that sense. And we're to be that way. We're to do justice. Micah 6:8 tells us to do justly. Right? It's one of the basic expectations that God has of us. The next word is pure. And pure here means pure. It means clean, innocent, modest, or perfect. James 3:17. If you look over there. James 3 and verse 17. James describes God's wisdom. He says, but the wisdom that is from above is first pure. There's nothing corrupt about it. There's nothing inappropriate. There's nothing perverse. It is pure. It's pure wisdom. In Titus 4, 1 Peter 3, there are a couple of encouragements to the women in particular that it says to be pure, be chaste, is how it describes it. In general and in conversation, it's that same word there is used, pure. In contrast, you have something that's corrupted, that's not quite pure. You think of Satan in the garden. When he goes and he presents his case to Eve, there's a lot of truth. If you go back and look at what he's saying, there's a lot of truth in what he said. He said some true things, but he mixed it up with a little bit of, you know, you're not really going to die. He threw in a little slant in there that just corrupted it, corrupted truth just enough to make it believable, and they followed it. So that's... that kind of thing isn't what we want to be, isn't what we want to be, and it's not what we want to be dwelling on or thinking about. We don't want to have the mentality and the thought of thinking along the lines of things that are mostly right, and you know we can mix in a little bit here and there. We need to be pure in our thoughts. And really only centered on things that we know are pure. If things aren't pure, if we're not sure whether it's pure or not, it's probably not something that we should dwell on. 1 John 3, verse 3, John writes us, and he tells us to be pure as Jesus Christ is pure. So we have this command, not just to think about it, not just to have it in mind, but actually to be pure. The next word here is lovely. And lovely is, this word is translated pleasing, agreeable, acceptable, amiable, friendly toward others, and not perverse. This is the only time that this word is used in the New Testament, this particular word. So we can't really compare against other usages or get context from other places in the Bible. But we can break the word down. The word there is prosphiles. P-R-O-S-P-H-I-L-E-S. Prosphiles. And when you look at that, it's pros, or for, you know, pro. I'm pro this, I'm pro that. And philes, same root as philia, as friend, right? It's friend or brotherly. And so it's toward friendship. It's promoting friendship. William Barclay has this to say. The Greek prosphile might be paraphrased as that which calls forth love, that which calls forth that brotherly love. There are those whose minds are so set on vengeance and punishment that they call forth bitterness and fear in others. There are those whose minds are so set on criticism and rebuke that they call forth resentment in others. The mind of the Christian is set on the lovely things, kindness, sympathy, forbearance. So he is a winsome person. He's able to, again, in that sense, instead of bringing these negative qualities out, to be able to bring out the lovely qualities, the good things in others, to Again, to call forth love. It actually has an implication that those who interact with someone who has this mindset of being lovely like to be with that person and like to look on that person. The way you might look on a nice piece of art or hear a nice piece of music and say, I really like that. I really enjoy hearing that. It evokes a certain pleasantness in you. We're to be thinking on things and to be the kind of people that can evoke a certain sort of pleasantness in others, is how it is the implication of the word, that it's something that sort of encourages love in other people. And so we are then to be lovely. Again, from the United News, 2009, to God, all of his people are lovely if they are growing in friendliness and in unity, overcoming bitterness and critical opinions and avoiding profanity, which is so common and prevalent in today's media-driven world. So again, to be lovely, we men don't necessarily think of our wives as being lovely. We don't necessarily think of ourselves as being lovely. I don't look in the mirror and say, I look lovely today. But again, it should be a descriptor that we have. Of good report means well spoken of or reputable. Of good report. It's only used in this form here again in the New Testament. The word is euphemos, and literally means good speaking. So well spoken of, right? Things that we hear, that we have in mind, should be things that are well spoken of. Those should be the things that we dwell on, right? And that should be a descriptor of who we are. We should be able to be well spoken of and growing in that. Right? You can compare this word euphemos. You'll think of the word euphemism, right? Euphemism has a negative connotation because of what has come to mean. It means, you know, a substitute for a kind of bad word. And so we don't use euphemisms because we're just essentially swapping out one bad word with a cleaner word, but the intent's the same. But the actual meaning of the word euphemism is to speak with fair words, and it essentially, the way that euphemism came to be euphemism is it's replacing an inappropriate word with something that's appropriate, with something that's better. And so it's well spoken of. It's better spoken of. It's a good word. So in that sense, we should be of good report. And also when we are processing information and when we have thoughts and when thoughts bubble up in us, they should be things that could be of good report. Those are the things that we should dwell on. If they're not of good report, again, you know, if you're an employer, you might have bad reports about an employee. You know, there are other situations where you might have to handle a bad report, right? Where you might hear a bad report and have to process it and work with it in some form. But it's not supposed to be the things that fill your thoughts. You're not supposed to be filled with things that are of poor report. And those are the things that I just dwell on. In 2 Corinthians 6, Paul uses a variant of this word. He uses the noun form of this word, translated good report, 2 Corinthians 6:8. And he contrasts it with a word translated evil report, which means defamation. So on the one hand, we're to think about the good things, the things of good report, the things of noble report, and to not spend so much time focused on things that are defamation. Those don't need to be the things that we fill ourselves with, and those shouldn't be the things that we are, right? We should be reputable, and especially before God. Virtue. He says, if there be any virtue, going back to Philippians, we're in Philippians 4. He says, if there is any virtue, if there's anything. Virtue here means excellence. It's also translated manliness. We'll explain that. Manliness in the sense of rescuing the damsel in distress, right? It's manliness, valor, not to exclude the ladies. But you get the intent, right? It's that same idea of taking every thought captive, right? It's heroic in that sense. This is virtue. It's the same word that Peter uses in his list, and he says, adding to your faith virtue. And he goes on, adding to virtue, and he has that whole list. But he says, Paul is saying here, virtue, this valor, this excellence, is what we need to strive toward. Again, from the United News article, January 2009, as we continue day by day in our fight against the pulls of this world, our own human nature, and the darts of Satan the devil, we grow slowly toward becoming excellent and praiseworthy. We very likely will not see this in ourselves, but others will begin to see a difference. And above all, God will see it and be pleased by the genuine character growth and the development he observes as we develops as we yield to him. So again, excellence. And the idea here is not just good. It's not just, oh, that's good. That's virtuous. It's virtue in action. So there's an active element to this word that really should drive us. Again, and reinforcing the point here that these are not just things that we think about. They're not just things, oh, let's think about these good thoughts. It's thinking about them and that sense of virtue, being able to put them into action, being actively good as we're encouraged. In contrast to that, it would not just be badness, right? So it's not just, oh, this is good and this is bad. But cowardice or inaction could also stand in contrast to virtue. Knowing good and thinking about good, but not doing good. There's really no in that sense of this word, there's no virtue in that because there's no active element associated with it. So we need to be doing good. He says, if anything is praiseworthy, right? If anything's commendable. Usually in the New Testament, this word praiseworthy or praise is describing praise toward God, right? Who is very worthy of commendation in all respects. Those are the things that we should be thinking about, the things that are worthy of praise. And again, very few things in this world are worthy of praise. The things of God are definitely worthy of praise. And so our minds should be centered on those things. Contrast to that, something shameful, something worthy of rebuke. Those things happen. We become aware of those things. But it's not where our minds need to be centered. Our minds don't need to be focused on the things that are not worthy of praise. So he sums it up and he says, if there's anything that you can describe with these qualities, think on these things. Think here is rendered a number of different ways. Sometimes it's translated reasoned, reckoned, concluded, accounted, esteemed, supposed. We're told to be reckoning on these things, be reasoning about these things. If you turn over to 1 Peter 1, verse 13, Peter contributes to the thought here. First Peter 1 and verse 13. So continuing from our original idea of taking every thought captive, right? Actively capturing those thoughts, subjecting them in a right and proper way according to some of these attributes. Peter adds in 1 Peter 1:13, he says, therefore, gird up the loins of your mind. Be sober. Rest your hope fully upon the grace that is to be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. He says, guard your minds. Get it in shape. Gird it up. Defend it. We need to have our minds sharp to the thoughts that come from within, the thoughts that will come at us from without. Remembering that as where we started in 1 Corinthians, subjecting thoughts is spiritual warfare. It's not something that we can just do solely on our own effort. We can just decide I'm going to do this. It's a spiritual warfare, and so it requires a spiritual element. It requires God's Spirit in us. It requires that that Spirit be active and be stirred up. His Spirit is His mind in us, right? That's one way that we describe it, is that His Spirit is His mind living in us. His mind active in us, right? His mind active in our thoughts, God's thoughts in our thoughts, right? It's God's Spirit active in us. And that's what makes the spiritual type of warfare possible. Focusing on these things, on things that can be described the way that Paul has described them in Philippians 4, helps stir up that spirit. It actually helps to encourage those things, to encourage God's Spirit to be active in us. In 2 Peter, a couple of times in 2 Peter, 2 Peter 1:13, 2 Peter 3:1, if you want to reference those. Peter, he says he wants to stir up his readers by bringing them to remembrance of something, by focusing their minds on something. He wants to stir them up by helping them to think about something, by centering their minds on a concept. And so it's something that we can actively do. Center our minds on these things. And be stirred up. Have God's Spirit stirred up within us. So again, it's not simply the scripture isn't something we should read and simply say, I need to think nice thoughts. Just need to think good things. I mean, we're told elsewhere that we're to sigh and cry for the sins of this world. Right? There are things that we should be thinking about that should give us alarm, that should. You know, it's not just, think about things that make you feel good. There's contrast to that. We have to have a certain amount of thought about the world we live in, be on guard against the things, process the things that we must deal with. But our thoughts, our attention should be centered on the good things, on the noble things, on the pure things, on the lovely things, on all of the things that Paul has outlined for us. Those things should characterize where our thoughts are in general. So let's take every thought captive. Let's hold them to these standards. Make sure they fit. And put all of these things into practice.